upstairs there.
Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is March 3, 2015. We have a lot of bills on the agenda today, members, so we'll jump right in. First bill up, Senate File 385, Senator Newman. Go ahead, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr.
Tell
Chairman.
Us about your bill.
Regarding Senate File 385, we are revisiting the issue of forfeiture in the state of Minnesota. And I tell you, would say, members, that the current bill has got two basic components in it. One is a reporting requirement, and the other is a requirement that would involve the prohibition of the use of the subject funds by various law enforcement for purposes of, say, salary and that type of thing. And I do have an amendment, which would be an author's amendment to A1 amendment, that will remove the prohibition of the use of funds for salaries and make some other change. So at this point, Mr. Chairman, I would offer the A1 amendment, and then I'll discuss what is left in the bill after the adoption.
All right. Not sure that we quite have a quorum yet here. So, Senator Newman, why? I see three senators in the room. More? Yeah, I got Senator Wimmer, champion. Who else?
Senator Newman.
And Newman, it's four. I'm sorry. I see four senators, and we still need one more. So why don't you go ahead and proceed to describe the amendment in the bill, and we'll adopt it when we have the quorum.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, what the A1 amendment does in terms of the bill is it eliminates the restriction of law enforcement to use forfeited funds for purposes of salary. That's the first important component of the amendment. The second
What's the purpose of that change, Senator Newman?
The law enforcement was not in support of that provision, and we have worked with law enforcement and also with the County Attorneys Association, and we're trying to have a bill that is as non-controversial as possible. I will tell you personally, Mr. Chairman and members, that I've always thought it is maybe not all that good of an idea to allow any state agency to acquire funds, be it from fines, penalties, whatever, and then be able to put it into their own budget. Rather, I've always believed that maybe what we should be doing with those funds is sticking them into general appropriations. However, for the purposes of this bill, we have agreed to remove that prohibition. And the members of the committee no longer have to be concerned about that issue.
All right. Senator Newman, did law enforcement then, as a collective entity, agree to support the bill or remain neutral on the bill in return for your removing this provision that was obnoxious to them?
Yeah. My understanding, Mr. Chairman, is that the County Attorneys Association, which is here and will be testifying in support of the bill as amended, is in support of the bill, and that would include law enforcement. And I will be asking the chairman to invite the County Attorneys Association spokesman to come to the table, you know, after we've presented the bill.
All right. What's the second change in the
second change has to do with a reporting requirement, and We essentially are combining the various areas of reporting these programs instead of having six separate reporting areas. We have now combined them into four reporting requirements, and that is accomplished. That is accomplished in the A1 amendment. The other thing that the amendment does is provide some comfort to the state auditor in placing the this bill under a different statutory section and addresses the effective date. And I would ask, Mr. Chairman, the state auditor, Rebecca Otto, is here with us, and she's under somewhat of a time constraint. I wonder if it would be all right if we would ask her to come up and make her comments on the A1 amendment at this time.
So go ahead, Senator Newman.
I was requesting, Mr. Chairman, if it would be all right if I invited the state auditor, Rebecca Otto, to come up to the table at this time. She's under a time constraint.
We will certainly
would like to comment on the A1 amendment.
Ms. Otto. State Auditor Otto, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Rebecca Otto, the state auditor. I'll be very brief. We just requested a few very technical changes with this bill, moving the reporting requirement into 6.74, which is more appropriate for annual reporting of information. And I just wanted to make you quickly aware of a couple things. Enactment date was important. Local governments will have to create some accounting codes to account for these specific expenditures. And we have to give them time for that, and so they would do that January 1 of the fall, you know, this coming year, and then we'd begin to collect that information in 2017. So that's important to allow to give them time to get that done. And also, I just wanted to make sure that the committee understands this data will be self-reported, so there's nothing we can audit it against, but that's the nature of also forfeiture data that we collect. And what's also being taken out is the financing or the funding of this additional work for our office. We'll have to do some work to our reporting forms, and I don't think this is a finance committee, but we were supposed to charge fees for each entity that reported to us, which is not a model that works with my very limited staff. So maybe we can work with another committee on figuring out how to get this done. And we're trying to keep it so it's extraordinarily limited. But with a limited, keeping the funding, you know, keeping it as efficient process as we can, our staff will not have the capacity to do a lot of chasing if there's not good compliance with the reporting. So that's it.
So, Ms. Otto, this bill, as amended, it will satisfy all of your office's concerns about it?
It will work, yes.
Great. Thank you. Do any of the members have any questions for State Auditor Otto? You must have done a good job. No controversy here.
Okay, good.
All right. Thank you very much. And thanks for coming back for the second version of this hearing so we could hear the bill.
Mr. Chairman, with Senator that explanation, Newman, perhaps Mr. McGrath could now walk us through the specifics of the bill.
And Mr. McGrath. Oh, yes,
and
Senator Newman.
This would be as amended now.
The description will be as if we had adopted the amendment, which we will address. Oh, we do have a quorum now. So we are in a procedural position to adopt the A1 amendment. I understand there may be a question or two about it before we do that. Senator Lemon.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Newman, the amendment, no matter how you slice it, whether you're for it or against it, it's controversial. And we've had this discussion before over the years regarding forfeiture laws, evidence seized, and then what if they were ever sold post an adjudication, where does that money go? And in the past, recent years, going back maybe 5-6 years, we've always said as a body that that money should not go toward the enhancement of any law enforcement budget, and specifically for the very reasons you discussed about the concern about whether or not law enforcement should be a beneficiary of anything that's seized I know it's in the form of an author's amendment, and we usually just blindly put those on in the form of a bill, but this one is of a little bit more of a controversial nature, and it has a historical record. This very issue has a historical record on this committee as well as throughout the House and Senate. So I'm a little perplexed because no one from the law enforcement community has asked me about this specific request, and I think that's the way it was framed, that law enforcement didn't like it. Well, I think we're the ones that make public policy, and we have made a history of public policy in recent years regarding where does money go in the form of forfeitures, where does it go in evidence seized, and then the evidence is eventually sold. Where does that money go? Does it go into some general fund, or does it go specifically into a budget specifically for the benefit of certain personnel in government? So my question is if we pass this amendment, does this amendment restrict it going to specific entities in government, or does it restrict it from going into a general fund? And if you could elaborate a little bit more on that, or perhaps maybe there's someone in the audience from the law enforcement community that would be willing to speak publicly about this.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Excuse me, Senator Limmer. The way I think I would like to handle that question is, first of all, I would like to formally offer the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. That would put it in front of us for purposes of discussion. And with that, I would ask that Mr. Small from the County Attorneys Association could maybe come up to the table and address Senator Limmer's questions.
The A1 amendment is before us.
Mr. Chairman, Small. Members of the committee, my name is Robert Small, and I am the executive director of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. We have had many very productive discussions with the senator and with the author of the bill, as well as the advocates of the bill, and we appreciate their time and working through our concerns. This was presented to us as a reporting bill. We have had, as I said, many fruitful discussions, and our concerns have been removed. We have no concerns about this bill. Senator Limmer's question and others is another discussion for another day, but not for this particular bill. And I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, Mr. Small,
yes.
First of all, we haven't adopted the A1 amendment yet, which ordinarily we do pro forma as an author's amendment, but there are some questions about it. And secondly, I think there's some questions about, you know, what's left of the bill if you remove this feature of it.
If I may.
Mr. Small, if you wouldn't mind addressing the question as Senator Limmer posed it, directly, I would appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, members, the current law provides for how the funds would be distributed, and the amendment doesn't change that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, earlier in the presentation, I think it may have, was it incorrect in the description of what the amendment does? I thought I heard in the earlier description of the amendment that the effort to, in the bill itself, that any funds that would come from a sale of a forfeiture property would, there was disagreement of where that money would be directed, and that there was a dispute by others, particularly in the law enforcement community, that this money would, in the original bill, not go toward a law enforcement purpose or budget. Was that description incorrect, or am I incorrect in my listening?
Might I defer to Senator Newman to answer that question?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer,
Senator Newman.
I don't know if I confused you or not on my initial presentation, but
easy to do.
The current law allows law enforcement to retain the proceeds of forfeited property, and they are able to use it for a variety of purposes. Mm-hmm. Could be and salaries and payment of overtime is one of them. It's my understanding that law enforcement and the County Attorney's Association objected to that provision. With the A1 amendment, I am removing that provision from the bill, and law enforcement will be able to continue to handle the proceeds of the forfeited funds in the same manner that they are currently handling them.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, so with the passage of the A1 amendment, law enforcement will be able to take proceeds from forfeited sales and apply them toward items such as salary and other programs that they may have if the A1 amendment is passed? And was the original intent of the bill to remove that direction of where those funds would go?
Mr.
Senator
Chairman,
Newman.
It's my understanding that with the A1 amendment, law enforcement will be put in the same position as they currently are with respect to the use of the forfeited funds. But perhaps I could put Senate counsel on the spot and have Senate counsel explain to us specifically the uses that law enforcement has and what they can use the forfeited funds for, and maybe that would answer Senator Limmer's question.
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair and members, if you look through the bill, sections 1, 2, and 4, the original bill, you can see the sections that are being that are there are talk about the disposition of forfeited funds. So, for example, on page 2, section 2, that's the DWI forfeiture law. Beginning on line 2.31, that's how law enforcement can currently use those funds. So you can see it's a supplement to the agency's operating fund or similar fund for use in DWI-related enforcement training and education. And I believe that language is almost identical for section 4, which is for the criminal code forfeitures. And then on page 3, line 1, that's the beginning of where the prosecutors can use the money. And it's also a supplement to their operating fund or similar fund for prosecutorial purposes. So it is fairly broad or general, but it is a supplement to those funds. So I believe currently they use it for overtime and things like that. And that's pretty common, I believe.
Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Counsel, if I can direct your attention to page 2, line 17 and through 19, does the amendment do anything to remove that language from the bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, yes, that's the A1 amendment. It, if you look on page line 1.2 and then 1.27 and 1.28, it deletes those sections. So it would have the effect of not adding that proposed new language to law. As Senator Newman said, it would basically remove those proposed restrictions, and it would continue to treat how law enforcement or prosecutor use that money, same as current law. That's the effect of it.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator
counsel
Lynn.
Again. So existing law, just to be clear, because I have to ask this question because I'm a co-author on this bill, and now a significant portion of this bill is being removed. And I have to be very clear on whether I keep my name on this bill. And so, counsel, the existing law allows proceeds from forfeited sales to go directly to salaries of law enforcement, and the sale would be managed by law enforcement personnel, or would it be certainly the forfeiture would be carried out by law enforcement personnel. Maybe you could give us a little background on how a forfeited sale comes to be and who does it.
Mr. Backus.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, perhaps if I could review that and answer that a little bit later point.
Okay. Council will research that on the spot. Does anyone at the table know the answer to the question off the top of their head?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I was otherwise engaged and didn't hear the question. Sorry.
How are the forfeitures conducted right now, and who pays for those salaries? Thank you. Did I catch that, Senator Limmer?
Yeah. Perhaps Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, Lee McGrath from the Institute for Justice. Under Minnesota law, forfeiture law today, law enforcement is able to act autonomously, but it does have two obligations. One is that it sells the property in a commercially reasonable manner. So, and part of that is a restriction that it cannot give the property to a police officer or a sheriff or something like that. It must sell it commercially reasonably. Second, there are some restrictions that exist in current law that require law enforcement to only use forfeiture funds to supplement operations. Part of that would include the salary and overtime expenses that are for police officers. That is something that we had hoped to take out of the bill by this clause on 217, but now are supportive of Senator Newman's A1 amendment. Did I answer your question, Senator Limmer?
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McGrath, the way the law is written now, as you described, would allow law enforcement to use this money partially for salaries, sometimes for overtime and some other programming that might be available. Is that with the blessing of the local political subdivision that would govern that particular police office, or would it be something that would be independent of a political subdivision as long as there's money available in the account?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, law enforcement may expend these funds independently, autonomously, under current law. It may be the practice of one municipality here or there that the funds be deposited into the general fund of the municipality and go through the city council. But that is not a requirement today under Minnesota law. Law enforcement is able to raise and appropriate its funds autonomously.
You have a request to testify on this point coming from behind you, Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin with the Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. In one of my previous lives, I was a bookkeeper and accountant, and had a number of things to do in the financial accounting of varying offices within public and private government. When funds come to either a chief or a sheriff through the forfeiture, under existing accounting laws of the cities and the counties currently, those funds must be separated and segregated into a fund for auditing purposes by the local auditor of the city or the county, and ultimately the state auditor. Secondly, when budgets are prepared, they are prepared, as you know, starting in May and submitted through the process and finalized in December for local units of government, and that budget is then set. As part of that budget setting process, there is a budget put forth with regards to operations by law enforcement, and in that, if there are funds that are going to be used from the forfeiture account, they are then transferred from that forfeiture account into the general fund so that the auditor or the accountant for the city or the county, when they do payroll and all of these other kinds of things, can balance their books. All of that goes through the varying city and or county governmental structures when budgets are set. Police chiefs and sheriffs do not keep a, quote, separate checking account where they take monies from that forfeiture and then do things with those without the consent of going through this budgeting process at the county or city level. We supported this change simply because we could continue to operate our current structure, and we felt that this was a reasonable compromise, and again, we felt there are safety factors built in for reporting, and we did support the reporting component of this because we think it is something that we can do and should be doing to be held to the highest accountable standards.
Mr. Franklin, perhaps you know or someone else does, what is sort of the range of operational budgets then of the law enforcement agencies that are funded directly or indirectly by forfeiture proceeds?
Mr. Chairman, it's been a long time since I've looked at that. My experience from my previous commands was that the bulk of the funds came from normal tax dollars, from the normal general fund, and was only supplemented through the forfeiture for special kinds of things, limited overtime or other kinds of special things that might come up. But again, it was the much smaller number than the larger number that was provided by the local community.
You don't have any figures available to share with us? Is it 5%? Is it 20% on average? I'm sure it varies agency to agency, but there must be some information out there that what the range might be.
Mr. Chairman, I'm unprepared to it would have to be some research. I just do not have that. I'm guessing that it is a small, much smaller percentage, probably 20% or less.
Mr. McGrath, do you have any information on that question?
Mr. Chairman, we did do a FOIA request for one county, and the number very anecdotally for this one county, Mr. Chairman, was approximately 10% of the drug task force came from forfeiture proceeds.
Of a drug task force? Which county was that? If I'm gonna ask.
It was Washington County.
And that was just funding specifically relating to the drug task force.
It was the public data disclosure request produced was a budget, and it showed as an input. Yes, it was just the drug task force, and it showed as an input all the sources of funds. One of them was forfeiture, and all the expenditures and the forfeiture constituted that percentage number.
Well, we're confronted with an author's amendment that has generated some serious questions. Let me recommend that, as we ordinarily do, as a courtesy to the author, we put the bill in the shape that he would like to have this committee consider it in. Then this committee can consider whether, in that new shape, we wish to what action we wish to take in connection with the bill. Is that your desire, Senator Newman?
It is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All those in favor of Senator Newman's A1 author's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Senator Newman, the bill has now adopted your author's amendment. As you may suspect from the conversation, it may have created some doubt as to whether or not or what shape, whether or in what shape this bill moves forward from here. But it's your bill, so you decide how to proceed, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And at this point, you know, we have discussed the bill, as amended at some length. But at this point, I think what I would like is if you would allow Mr. McGrath to go through the remaining portion of the bill as amended so he can explain to you what remains after we have adopted this amendment.
Mr. McGrath.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. I will go back and forth between the amendment and the pre-amended bill and ask the committee to turn to page 3 because the first two pages have been deleted by the amendment. The first remaining section of page 3 is section 3, and you can see that what we're doing is crossing out a charge that existed by this committee when Senator Moi was the chairman for various private organizations to establish a policy. This is a bit of a UNCOLA session act here.
Mr. McGrath, I'm going to interrupt you just for a quick second, not related to the substance of your testimony, but something that has bugged me in the legislature for many years is when we refer to female chairs or former chairs of committees as chairmen. So I'm going to ask that as a matter of protocol, in this committee at least, where I have some authority, that when we refer to the chair, we simply refer to that person as the chair without any gender-specific commentary. And I know it's just a matter of pattern and practice and custom and usage or whatever you want to call it around here, so I guess I'm serving notice now for folks. I'm making a request. No one's going to get sanctioned or anything like that. And I'm sorry you're just the one that happened to say it in front of me when I caught it, but please, for a future reference.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
this committee,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair, and thank you for the correction, and I will do my best.
Mr. McGrath.
On page 3, line 323, we are deleting references to private organizations that were charged by this committee a number of years ago to develop a policy. But you can see, starting on line 4.16, we are not deleting the policy that they came up with. And so, Mr. Chair, this is really just housekeeping in which we are deleting references to a process that has been successfully completed. Mr. Chair, moving on then. In section 4, that is deleted by the A1 amendment. And we then now turn to section 5 of the bill on page 5, line 517. And what the bill does here, what the amendment does here, is it implements State Auditor Otto's request that we change this reporting requirement from section 609.5315 to section 6.74. Flipping the page, Mr. Chair, what the amendment does to page 6 of the bill is to combine categories, but not to change substance. The first combination is the amendment makes is on line 6.7 to combine it with line 6.8. And the second combination is to combine line 6.10 with line 6.11. Finally, Mr. Chair, the amendment deletes little parenthetical G, as State Auditor Otto remarked, she does not have the facility to collect these funds. I'm happy to answer any questions about the bill, Mr. Chair, or to tell you why my organization supports it.
Yes, Mr. McGrath, if you would please explain why your organization supports the bill in its amended form and what the position of your organization is in connection with the deletion of the provisions relating to restriction on expenditures of forfeited proceeds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. We are the country's leading advocates for forfeiture reform. My colleague is testifying in the state of Maryland on a bill authored by Senator Jamie Raskin at this very, very moment. And we have also testified in other state legislatures.
A law school colleague of mine, by the way, Senator Raskin.
I will give him your regards.
Please do.
Senator Latz. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, you and your colleagues in the legislature have more information about forfeiture than any peer of yours in any state legislature. Thanks to your prior work, legislators know that there are 7,000 forfeitures a year that occur in Minnesota, or roughly 20 a day. You and your colleagues know that $9 million worth of property is seized annually, and approximately $7 million of it is redistributed to law enforcement. Most importantly, one fact that you know that no other state legislator knows is that the average seizure is $1,400. It is not, and this speaks to what is happening through civil forfeiture and why it is so challenging to hire a defense attorney when the average seizure is so small. You know that 95% of all seizures are less than $5,000. This is valuable information that has been at the source of the type of advocacy that my organization, as well as others like the ACLU, have advanced in the state legislature. What you don't know, and what the amended version of Senate File 385 will tell you, is how is law enforcement using that $7 million? Is it and is it using it for training? Is it using it for equipment? What is the purpose of it? And it is hard at this moment to speculate as to what will be inferred from that research, but it is important information that we think will have two effects. One, it will shine a light on law enforcement's use of forfeiture of funds. And secondly, it will have a salutary effect to ensure that law enforcement continues under its obligation to only use forfeiture to supplement existing operations, which is the current law. Mr. Chair, you asked why my organization and others in my coalition agreed to the concession in the amendment. It is because we think there is a better way to address the problem of law enforcement using forfeiture funds and having an incentive. Senator Limmer has expressed some of what we hope would be future legislation to address a real solution, as opposed to just a statement in statute, a prohibition in statute about the limits on forfeiture usage.
Mr. McGrath, I'm still a bit confused as to how you perceive that this bill will give us further information on the use, in part because I'm looking at the remaining categories, the consolidated categories. There is nothing in the reporting requirements, at least that I see here in the bill, that specifies uses for salaries or overtime or the categories that are being deleted, even in the reporting requirements.
That's a good point.
Mr. Chair, I accept your observation that that is a shortcoming of the amended version of the bill, that we do not, it would not provoke that type of information.
Senator Lindman.
Mr. Chair, you caught a you made an observation that I think I did too. On the back page, page 6, lines 14, I would like to introduce a verbal amendment, oral amendment. 614, we'd create a new sentence, started with the number 6, and after that, the words salaries and any other related benefits. The reason I'm bringing this up, Mr. Chair, or perhaps we want to get the wording first and then we can explain it.
Well, Senator Limmer, let me suggest possibly that you consider simply inserting the language that was otherwise deleted. For example, on lines 5.14 to 16, which is just repeated three times in the bill, so I took one of them. And just refer to, from line 15, starting with base salaries, and then through to the end of line 16.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, that's a better suggestion than mine. I withdraw the words that I describe my amendment and use that as a revised amendment, Mr. Chair.
Council understands Senator Limmer's proposed amendment. Senator Limmer, is it your intent to have a separate category identifying only the language that we just specified and to separate out the other uses general category? Because if it's mixed in with other uses as well, it's less useful.
I don't know, Mr. Chair. Perhaps counsel can give me a little better definition between the two categories that we're trying to define.
Senator, well, perhaps, but I think other uses, as it's listed, doesn't require you to specify what other uses are. It'll just be lumped in a column headed other uses. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if other uses really gets us anywhere. I could also see where it could create a real accounting difficulty for someone who is going to be handling this type of responsibility, and they're going to be scratching their head saying, well, what else do we put into this report? Maybe is there any other discussion on that?
Yeah, Mr. McGrath or Senator Newman, when you reached the agreement with State Auditor Otto to consolidate the categories, was there any magic to the number 4 that you received there, or was it simply an effort to simplify it to some degree?
Mr. Chair, there was the state auditor was not concerned by the number of categories, whether there be 4, 5, or 6. The state auditor could accommodate what you're suggesting, which is to insert a new number 6 and regarding salaries and other related salaries, benefits, overtimes, or bonuses to personnel or to pay to a private attorney for services related to forfeiture litigation as a new number 6 and to move other uses to number 7.
Okay. So, Senator Limmer, that makes sense to you?
It makes sense to me, Mr. Chair.
All right. So let's just make sure we're clear on the amendment. And counsel has suggested that for clarity purposes, we work off of the language in the A1 amendment. So essentially, between lines 19, or at lines 19 and 20, we'd be inserting a new number 4, and then as described, and then changing number 4 on line 20 to 5. Does that sound right, counsel?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, you'd also need on line 1.14 to change 4 to 5. So I think that the new clause 4, if I could maybe read what I believe it would be clause 4, base salaries, benefits, overtime, or bonuses to personnel, or private attorneys for services related to forfeiture litigation.
Probably need to move "and" from the end of line 19 to the end of the amendment as well.
Mm-hmm.
Members of the committee, what say you? Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, the reason why I'm bringing this amendment forward is the original bill would have put restriction on the use of proceeds from forfeiture sales and would have made it. The original bill claimed that could not be used to pay base salaries, benefits, overtime, et cetera. Now that that has been removed from the bill, we should at least know through the recording requirement listed on the amendment on lines 1.11 through at least 1.20. That any salaries that are paid would be included in the report. And I think that's only appropriate, Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman, what do you think about this proposed amendment to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I am in agreement with Senator Limmer in terms of this proposal, and I am prepared to accept it as a friendly amendment, but I would ask if perhaps Mr. Small could come forward and express what his thinking is on this oral amendment.
Mr. Small and Ms. Haas. Ms. Haas.
Mr. Chair and members, Nancy Haas with Messerly and Kramer here on behalf of the County Attorneys Association. I think our interest in having the categories was to make it as meaningful in a reporting standpoint as possible. I guess I would just say we would look forward to maybe fine-tuning the language. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I'm not sure where Mr. McGrath came up with the language related to 3.2 to 3.22, so I'm not entirely sure that it's absolutely meaningful. For example, pay a private attorney for services related to a forfeiture litigation. I think that's maybe happened one time. To the extent it's all in one category and it's talking about overtime and it's supplemental from a salary perspective. I mean, I think we're open to figuring out language that accomplishes the goal. I don't know if these words actually do it, but we'd be happy to continue the conversation to get at the desired outcome.
Okay, so you're supportive of the concept?
It could be, Mr. Chair.
Could be.
Spoken like a lawyer, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Newman,
for purposes of the bill, I would state that I do agree with Senator Limmer, and I would accept his amendment as a friendly amendment. I will also continue to talk to you.
Well, members, just FYI, this bill, should it pass, goes to the floor. So it's a lot easier to fine-tune language here in committee than it is on the Senate floor.
Shoe level.
Mr. Chair, if I could add a little bit more to the discussion, maybe I can lend a historical perspective to this discussion. For in recent years, the last 5 to 6 years, and I mentioned it earlier, but maybe it was not made strong enough, we have been recognizing ever since the street gang, the Metropolitan Street Gang Task Force, where there were serious issues raised about the use of evidence seized and other forfeitures in the proceeds from those sales. It raised the serious question of whether or not law enforcement personnel should be directly beneficiaries of properties that are seized, whether it's legal or illegal, that there be a proper accounting and that those proceeds be delivered instead of directly into a fund that would benefit law enforcement agencies, but it would instead be given to a general fund so that there's a separation of the travel of those monies. That would enhance, by doing that, it would enhance the accounting procedures and gain a little bit more public transparency to the use of when forfeitures and evidence sales are made and the travel of those proceeds to a general fund instead of directly to the very same personnel that might be seizing the property. I think that's good government. I think that's the way the public should be accounting for its funds in this manner.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry that I had to leave out for a short period of time to talk to some constituents, but I'm happy about the constituents, but just timing was bad, let me just say. So I did not get a chance to hear all of the discussion, but what I would like to do, Mr. Chair, is that I would like to reinsert the language, and if counsel can help me, I would like to reinsert the language that was taken out from the amendment, specifically around the appropriate agency or prosecuting authority may not use the proceeds from the sale, yada, yada, yada. So I'd like to reinsert the language that was at 2.17 to 2.19, as well as 3.20 to 3.22. And the language at 5.14 to 5.16, that would be my motion, because I think, and if you want me to give some context, I do think that it's important for there to be an accounting of those proceeds, and that I do think it's important to support law enforcement, but for law enforcement not to use forfeited proceeds for supplementing budgets and doing any of those things, especially around salaries and overtime, because it creates an imbalance in my mind. So with that being said, Mr. Chair, that would be my motion.
Mr. Chairman, point of procedure.
So then would I have to?
Mr. Backus, would you please explain what the proper form of the motion should be in terms of the language and the sections of the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Does Senator Limmer not have a motion on the floor at the present time?
Right.
That is correct, Senator Newman, and I think this would be in the nature of a motion, a substitute motion. Procedurally, that would be the nature of the offer to make. Either that or Senator Limmer would need to withdraw his motion and return to it if Senator Champion's motion did not pass. I mean, they're both kind of, it's really an either-or situation here.
Sure, and the only reason I'm inquiring is I want to know which motion are we properly dealing with so we can address, that's all.
Chairman, I'll withdraw my motion for now.
Very good, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Senator Limmer withdraws his motion. So we have before us a motion by Senator Champion And Mr. Backus is going to describe the motion clearly for us.
Mr. Chair and members, the easiest way to, I think, conceive of this is if you simply go back to the original bill, it would be reinserting into the bill sections 1, 2, and 4.
I'm going to do two things. First of all, I'm going to ask Senator Newman for your position on this proposed amendment, but also we did have some other testifiers that had signed up to testify, and since we're kind of dealing with core issues on the bill, I think before we take action on this amendment, or if we get to it, another round of Senator Limmer's amendment, that we ought to hear from anyone else in the room that wishes to testify in connection with these topics. Is that okay with you, Senator Newman?
It is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Newman, did you want to weigh in on anything right now, or should we just ask the other people that signed up if they want to testify at this time?
Actually, Mr. Chair, maybe we could have the other folks who have signed up to testify could do it now. That would give me a chance to think about Senator Champion's motion.
All right. Fair enough. So I have... in the order in which we have it on the agenda here, Ben Feist from the ACLU. Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm the legislative director with the ACLU of Minnesota, and I'm here in support today of the bill. I'm not sure exactly what shape it's going to be in, but I can say that as first amended, we were still in support of the bill as we were of the original bill because it would be a step forward, providing transparency and accountability in the reporting. Of course, as Mr. McGrath and I had put thought into this to begin with, we believe that the original language in the bill would be sufficient way to go through, but then, of course, over the course of the negotiations with the County Attorneys Association, we were comfortable paring it back a little bit, and as Mr. McGrath alluded to, we will probably be back to work on additional issues in the forfeiture realm in future sessions. It's been an incremental approach since probably 2009, and we believe that there's still a lot of work to be done. We just want to be realistic about what we can do this session. But with that, I think we could support any of the versions that are currently floating around out there.
So, Mr. Feist, since you have the mic, do you have any recommendation to this committee regarding whether or not we should adopt Senator Champion's motion to reinstate the language that was stricken by the author's amendment?
Mr. Chair, as a general point, we certainly supported this language as the bill was brought up to begin with. We believe it would be good policy to keep it that way, but we did enter into good faith negotiations with county attorneys and wanted to take their concerns very seriously. So without trying to undo that work that we had done, I think we could be fine either way.
Any questions from members of the committee for Mr. Feist? Thank you, Mr. Feist. I also had on the list Shelley Schrofer from the Minnesota State Patrol. She's Lieutenant Colonel Schrofer. I saw her in the room earlier. Someone else approaching from the Department of Public Safety. And then I see Mr. Neumeister is anxious to testify as well. Go ahead, please.
Right. Chair, members, my name is Kate Weeks. I'm the legislative director at the Department of Public Safety. Lieutenant Schrofer had to leave for another meeting. She apologizes for not being here. Currently with the State Patrol, we do use forfeitures as a means to enforce DWI laws that were passed by the legislature and signed into law in the state of Minnesota related to the DWI forfeitures. Currently, we fund 8 full-time employees at the department to administer those laws and that program. And so Restricting the use on that would greatly impede our ability to enforce the statutes related to DWI laws. Obviously, Lieutenant Colonel Schroefer is more articulate in this area, and she apologizes that she can't be here, but it is a tool that the State Patrol does use.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Weeks, do you have an idea of what those eight people do?
Yes.
Ms. Weeks.
A lot of it is, the coordinators handle the documentation and paperwork necessary for a successful prosecution, handle the release of property, towing bills, attorney's bills, and other administrative functions directly related to the vehicle forfeiture.
So this is sort of the back office administrative support for the forfeiture program, is that right?
Yes, to ensure that we follow all of the rules and regulations regarding forfeiture in the state.
And does the department or the State Patrol use the forfeiture proceeds to supplement the troopers who are out on the road enforcing the forfeiture laws there? If you know.
I am not absolutely positive, but I can get that information for you.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman, it's easy to get confused here. I don't think the discussion is about whether or not there should be seizure or forfeiture. That's not the question. The question is, what do we do with the money after it has been seized and ultimately sold? And we're debating whether or not it should be applied towards salaries or not to the very same people that were doing the seizing and causing the forfeiture. And so that's really the issue. I don't think there's an issue of whether or not property can or cannot be seized. If there's illegal activity, I think that's fair game for us to consider. But where does the money go? And where does it go back to without having a specific accounting through a general fund? I think that's really the issue.
The information that I have is that, Senator Limmer. The information that I have is the State Patrol has approximately 8 employees who work as the coordinators. I do not believe that those, I will need to check and I can get back to the committee on whether or not any of the forfeiture proceeds also go to support troopers. But it is my understanding that those proceeds go directly to the administrative staff to help administer the forfeiture program.
I have a note from Senate research that suggests that in the House, the State Patrol testified that without this use of the forfeiture proceeds, they would have to draw further funds from the trunk highway fund in order to pay for these administrative functions. Ms. Weeks, is that where that money would come from, or would it require a separate supplemental budget or general budgetary appropriation to pay for those administrative positions?
Chair Latz, it's my understanding that most of the State Patrol is funded through trunk highway funds, and so if the forfeiture proceeds were not able to use those for the 8 administrative positions, it would have to come from the trunk highway fund.
Okay. Mr. Turner, do you have any additional information to share with us on State Patrol funding in this regard?
Mr. Chairman, members, I concur with what Ms. Weeks says, that the State Highway Patrol is funded by the Trunk Highway Fund. It has some general fund appropriations within our bill, but they're not related to forfeiture.
So if this amendment were to pass, it would not create any additional fiscal implication that would need to be considered by the Senate Finance Committee?
If, Mr. Chairman, this amendment, let me get this straight.
So
this
my
amendment,
question was pretty general. How about just for the State Patrol?
This amendment would disallow the use of forfeiture funds for salaries. Is that correct?
Yes.
Then it would have, this amendment would have an impact on the Trunk Highway Fund.
And Mr. Turner, do we directly appropriate out of the Trunk Highway Fund to the State Patrol, or is that?
Mr. Chairman, members, this committee has one direct appropriation from the Trunk Highway Fund, and it has to do, it's I think, $2.9 million a year. And it has to do with funding forensic lab activities with State Patrol DWIs. Other than that, this if this committee were to pass this amendment, it would probably, if it wanted to maintain jurisdiction over the bill, it would have to fund this amendment with its general fund target, or else this bill would have to go to transportation.
As a policy committee or their finance division?
Mr. Chairman, members, I would guess that it would be the finance division of transportation.
Okay. For consideration of funding to take care of those administrative costs that we'd be
Mr. Chairman,
defunding
correct.
This way. Anything further on that discussion, Ms. Weeks?
Chair Latz, no. Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Weeks? Thank you. Mr. Neumeister?
Mr. Chairman, members, Mr. Chair, members of the Judiciary Committee, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. This is a historical thing that I've followed for a great number of years. When Dan Mabley was representing Hennepin County as a lobbyist for Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and when State Senator Mike Freeman came with the forfeiture laws in the late 80s, there was no kind of reporting at all. And every year there's been a little bit more reporting, and I think this goes to finally, as bills and laws are made, you adopt a little bit each time. So I think this is one of the great things, and I'm very supportive of these kind of reporting mechanisms. The one thing in regards about Senator Champion's language, I think is a very good thing to start with. You've got to remember, it's $7 million we're dealing with. $7 million may go for some salaries, but there should not be an incentive to do that. $7 million was what basically the state, according to the state auditors, how much law enforcement agencies got last year. But I do think, and it's very important, and I just look at those six items where our reporting, which are now combined into four, there might need to be some staffing. Substance abuse prevention programs, gang programs, because sometimes law enforcement agencies, they'll do outreach in the community. And sometimes you'll need to pay staff to do those kinds of things. And as long as that's not part of a permanent staff or where they do programming or whatever, or they may contract out to a community organization or whatever to do some of those things, because I know a lot of law enforcement agencies do that kind of outreach with sometimes this kind of money. And it's, you know, how they spend the money is used in many different ways in all the counties and agencies of the state. So, Chair Latz and members of the Judiciary Committee, I think it's important to continue transparency and accountability, and I'm glad that you're still taking that move to do that, because was with your one of your predecessors, Senator Merriam, that I testified at the same table, and he liked the idea that I proposed at that time that it go to the state auditor for some kind of reporting. And it's been continuous on ever since. And I'm glad, you know, that you were one of the sponsors to expand it a couple of years ago after the state gang strike task force. It always helps to make folks accountable. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. So is there anyone else in the audience I didn't have on the list that wanted to be heard to testify in connection with this matter before the committee? So we have before us right now Senator Champion's amendment. It was offered after Senator Limmer, or in lieu of Senator Limmer's amendment. And maybe we have some discussion on the committee, which route we prefer to go as a committee. So I will return first to Senator Newman or Mr. McGrath or both of you as to, I know you've got an agreement that you had made, but on the merits of the bill and considering what you'd like to accomplish this legislative session, could you tell us what direction you would prefer to go?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chief Author.
At this stage, although I agree with the spirit of Senator Champion's motion, I would not agree to it for a couple of reasons. First of all, this apparently would get into the area of a fiscal note and funding with respect to the State Patrol. And I don't know what that amount would be. It would be, therefore, an issue that I would prefer to visit at some time in the future. I will also tell you, Mr. Chair and members, that we did have, Mr. McGrath and myself, fairly extensive conversations with the County Attorneys Association. I will tell you that I am not real comfortable with breaking that faith with the County Attorneys Association, because that's what we came in here with. And I would like to continue to have the discussion with that organization and law enforcement insofar as the use of these funds, but I am not prepared to go forward with that notion today. And therefore, for purposes of the committee, I would oppose the Champion motion for that purpose, and I will parenthetically indicate that I would support the Limmer motion that had previously been offered.
All right. Is there any further discussion in connection with Senator Champion's motion? Does everyone understand the motion that we'll be voting on? All right. All those in favor of Senator Champion's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
May I have a moment, Mr. Chair?
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that, I would lay the bill on the table.
Senator Newman moves to lay the bill on the table. It is done. Senate File 385 is laid on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Senator Newman. All right, Senate File 464. Senator Kent has been waiting patiently. Members, we have what we believe is a technical bill before us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. Yes,
Senator
we
Kent.
Believe this is a technical bill. It was brought to me by the Department of Public Safety, and it provides updated cross-references and other necessary changes as a result of an unsessioned bill in 2014. Mr. Turner's summary shows the specific sites from 2014 session laws, Chapter 212 in Article 5. And with that, Ms. Engler from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension will provide the details.
Thank you. Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Katie Engler from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As Senator Kent has indicated, in Chapter 212 of the 2014 session laws, there was a direction to the reviser of statutes to look at all the repealers that had been part of that bill and determine if there were any other changes that were needed. And the bill before you, Senate File 464, is the result of that work by the reviser's office. Section 1 removes references to sections that were repealed relating to something known in the 1930s as radio receiving sets. Section 2 makes a similar change and updates one reference from a broadcasting station to what we now know as public safety answering points. Section 3 and 4 remove a reference to a repealed section and replaces that authority with an existing statute related to the secure network operated at the Bureau. Section 5 is probably the most difficult to explain. There were many employees in the past at the forensic laboratory at the Bureau who were covered by the State Patrol retirement plan. One of the sections that was repealed last year related to civil service laws back from the time when the Bureau was an independent agency before it was incorporated into the Department of Public Safety. What Section 5 does is ensures that those retired forensic laboratory employees who are drawing their retirement from the State Patrol plan continue to be able to do so. Section 6, 7, and 8 remove references to a section that was repealed. That section related to a prohibition on employers retaliating against crime victims. And Section 9 repeals the section that currently requires telegraph and telephone companies to give priority to messages or calls directed to broadcasting stations. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Are there any questions for Ms. Engler?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Engler, is anything in the bill considered a substantive change in policy in your perspective?
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, no.
Is there anyone else in the room that wishes to testify in connection with Senate File 464? Not seeing anyone come forward.
Is there a motion? Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 464 be recommended to pass and move to where? The Senate floor?
This goes to the floor, Senator
Limmer.
Right.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer moves that Senate File 464 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Every bill should be that well presented.
Yes. Senate File 666, Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and
committee
members.
I take it this does have some substance to it, not just technical.
Oh.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would say it's mostly technical corrections, but we will go into the details of Senate File 666. It's, as you recall, last year we passed the Revised Uniform Liability Company Act, which will become effective on August 1st of this year. Since then, the Minnesota State Bar Association, its various sections have been, and committees have been working on some technical amendments and corrections to the bill, and that's what you have in front of you. It provides for additional clarity and reconciles language that cross-references the Business Corporation Act, among other housekeeping items. First, it reconciles conversion of entities so they all work together within the framework of the existing body of law. Second, it corrects cross-references that were erroneously missed. Third, it will keep in place the original bargain that parties covered by the prior LLC law agreed upon, and this applies to default rules that are different than the revised LLC. In the revised LLC than the prior LLC law. Fourth, it provides comfort to lenders and borrowers by bringing in safe harbor language from the prior LLC law. And fifth, it clarifies certain lien provisions. This is a very high-level overview of the changes. I have with me Mr. William Klein, who will provide further testimony and answer any questions the committee may have. But as I mentioned, the revisions have been advocated by the Minnesota State Bar Association and have been vetted by them. So we'll bring them to you for further consideration and approval.
Any questions so far, members? We have somebody here to testify, Senator Franzen?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, my name is Bill Klein. I am with the Gray Plant Moody Law Office in Minneapolis, and I am currently vice chair of the business section of the State Bar
Excuse
Association.
Excuse me, could you bring in your mic, sir? We can't hear you up here.
Okay. Is that a little better? My name is Bill Klein. I am a lawyer with the Great Plant Moody office in Minneapolis, and I am also the vice chair of the business section of the Bar Association and a co-chair of the Partnerships and Limited Liability Companies Committee of that section of the bar. Last year, as Senator Franzen indicated, the revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act was adopted in Minnesota. That had been drafted several years before in large part and was modified somewhat as it was adopted. But that act also interacts with the prior Limited Liability Company Act, Section 322B, and also the Business Corporation Statute, Section 302A. And as we looked, and also last year, there were some changes made to the 302A Business Corporation Act provisions regarding conversion of entities. Some of those changes were not consistent with one another. And as we saw all of the legislation that was passed last year, we realized that by August 1st of this year, we needed to make the conversion provisions of the various acts work together. And so that's one of the goals of this. The other goal, or the other piece that might have some substance to it, is we did ask, we looked at the new act and the old act. The old act had certain default provisions that apply unless the members of a limited liability company agree otherwise, as does the new act, but they are not all the same default provisions. And members of the bar thought that if parties were members of an LLC that had certain statutory rules applying to them as default rules, the law should not change their deal. And so one of the sections of this act preserves some of those default rules for the prior act LLCs. And the other changes of some substance, they're not really changes. One is a clarification. The current LLC Act has a provision that discusses when a limited liability company can either lend money or guarantee obligations of another party. That was not included in the new act. The banker section of the bar thought it would be helpful. We considered that and believe it is helpful because it provides clarity that an act in guaranteeing an obligation of another party or making a loan, if it is meets certain procedural provisions that are set forth, will be deemed an authorized act of the limited liability company. That is something that provides assurances to both the lenders and the borrowers and also to borrowers' counsel who sometimes have to give opinions on the authorization of the act. The other piece that had some substance to it, and I believe it's probably more clarification, there's a provision in the revised Uniform LLC Act that provides that an evidence of an interest can be created by a certificate. And that raised a question among the lenders as to how you create and perfect a lien on that when that LLC interest is pledged as collateral for a loan. There's a provision in the Uniform Commercial Code that provides that if you have a certificated security and you grant a lien and the lender obtains possession of the certificate, they have a first lien even if a financing statement is filed. This type of certificate doesn't meet that requirement, and so we added some provisions to clarify that that would not be a certificate for purposes of taking possession and perfecting the lien. Absent a provision in the limited liability company agreement that specifically elected into the provisions of the Uniform Commercial Code that address that subject.
Do any members that have any idea what he just said have any
questions? Madam Chair, and there's also another testifier in case members have questions from legal advisor to the Secretary of State, Bert Black. Mr. Black is here as well for any questions that are relevant for that.
Madam Chair,
any questions?
I did, and I agreed with the previous testifier.
Excellent. Any questions from members? Would you like Mr. Black to come up, Senator Franzen?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I am Bert Black, legal advisor to the Office of the Secretary of State. The Office of the Secretary of State did participate in the drafting process for the bill before you and have no objections.
Okay,
and
thank
I'll be
you,
glad to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Any questions? Okay, members?
Madam Chair.
Would you like to make a motion?
Madam Chair, I just had one question, and that's on the issue of conversion. In a simple way, could you tell me what we're converting from and to? I know we're converting to a corporate identity, but what are we converting from?
Is it a different Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, it is a provision that's been in the law that allows an entity, a limited liability company, to become a corporation without it being treated as any transfer of assets. The entity is a different form afterwards, or it could go the other direction where a corporation could convert and become a limited liability company. And allowing a conversion permits this to happen in an easy way. It avoids mergers. It avoids transfers of assets. It avoids title problems. And it's something that started being adopted in the states, I would say, probably about 10 years ago, and it is now fairly common in Minnesota. The law only permitted conversions from Minnesota LLCs to Minnesota corporations until last year, when it allows conversion into other entities. But it's basically a way to change your form of doing business without a lot of other disruptive effects.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Black?
And Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, in 2014, we had 460 of these conversions. 232 wound up being from LLCs to corporations, and 228 wound up being from corporations to LLCs.
Mr. Black, I have one question for you. Is there any fiscal impact to the Secretary of State's office?
There, based on the number of conversions that we've had, there will be a fees were passed last year. You'll see that there's a $60 fee in the section in 322C for filing a conversion. That actually replaces language that imposed the $60 fee last year. So that is not a change. However, there is a change for the corporation fee and for the LLC, the old 322B LLC's fee, which currently is simply $35. The reason that last year $60 was chosen for the conversion fee is because that matches the similar fee of $60 for mergers. And $60 is the merger fee pretty much throughout our corporate law. So, if you will, it's sort of like setting a price point in the private sector, that all these similar transactions should be at $60. There is, by my calculation, there will be an increase in revenues of $5,750 approximately each year from the increase from $35 to $60.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Then would you suggest that we get a fiscal note on this?
Well, I've just completed the fiscal note for the House.
For the House. Okay.
Excuse me. The other body.
The other body. Okay, then, does somebody want to make a motion to move this to full Finance Committee?
Sure, I'll move the bill.
All right. Senator Limmer moves. Senate File 666. Ms. Pontius, did you have a comment?
That's
Mr. Black, are those general fund fees? The fees, would they flow into the general fund?
Madam Chair, Mr. Turner, I believe that is correct. Those are general fund fees.
And you said, Madam Chair, Mr. Black, you said $5,000?
$5,750.
Okay. So we rounded up. Madam Chair, members, I think the bill should go to finance. votes, and I think it will be a formality, but I think they will vote.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Turner. Then Senator Limmer moved for Senate File 666 to pass and go to Finance. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senate File 666 will go to full Finance thank you. Committee. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Madam Chair?
Oh, Senator Pappas?
Senator, I have a really short bill, and Senator Eakin said I could go ahead of him.
Well, then,
it's okay.
That would be fine. Thank you.
Won't we determine if it's short, Mr. Madam Chair?
I think Senator Limmer is going to decide whether it's short or not.
That could be the curse of death.
Who is coming up here with me?
All right, Senator Pappas is presenting Senate File 675.
Madam Chair, just to be very brief, that this is a process whereby a local county, a local process, could decide if they want to convert to an appointed system of county row officers, auditor, treasurer, recorder. And this proposal has been around for quite a while. In fact, I passed it about 20 years ago, and it was vetoed by Governor Carlson, former state auditor Governor Carlson. But really, the locals have come together, the Association of County Officers and the Association of Counties, to really work on this process. And they do support it. And they have to have a public hearing. They have to go through a process. There's a reverse referendum if the public wants to keep their auditor, treasurer, recorder, and an elected position. And I believe there's only one small section in the bill that relates to Judiciary Committee, and that is
Subdivision
4, but what section?
Decide not to file this bill.
Has to be a section. Section 4? Subdivision 4. And what comes under the jurisdiction of the Judiciary?
It's the discharge of
the motion. On what lines?
Starting on
3.19, the section discharge or demotion, I guess, is what comes under your jurisdiction. And one of you want to explain it? Okay, great. Mr. Martin.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is
Mr. Martin? Martinson?
Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, yes. Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Jim Martin. I'm with Booth Law Group from Minnetonka, Minnesota. And I was asked by the Minnesota Association of County Officers to draft language regarding discharge or demotion for elected county officers who are converted to appointed positions. And so I developed this discharge demotion language, and it is based on language that's already in statutes, in various statutes. The Subdivision 4, Subdivision 4A regarding demotion or discharge for incompetency or misconduct comes right out of the Veterans Preference Act, Minnesota Statute 197.46, and it's been found by courts to constitute a just cause standard for termination. The process for arbitration in the event a county officer is to be discharged or demoted and decides they wish to contest that action by the board is set forth in Subdivision 4B, and it grants the officer an arbitration process if they wish. They have 10 days to contest the action by the board. And if they do contest it, then the matter goes to arbitration. And if the parties can't decide on an arbitrator, then a request goes to the Bureau of Mediation Services. A list of 7 arbitrators is provided, and the parties strike until an arbitrator is left. And then binding arbitration is held to determine whether or not the action to demote or discharge the officer should be upheld. And this arbitration language, in fact, is out of the Teacher Continuing Contract Statute, Minnesota Statute 122A.40.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Any questions for Mr. Martin? Seeing none, Senator Pappas, you have another testifier?
Madam Chair, Ms. Roth from the Association of County Officers was really here to explain the bill. And I did a very, very brief explanation, but if anyone would like any more explanation about the whole bill other than this section that's in your jurisdiction, she could certainly fill you in or ask questions if my explanation wasn't adequate.
Any questions, members? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Pappas. And would someone, is there anybody else in the audience that wants to testify, either for or against the bill? Seeing none, could I get a motion on Senate File 675?
Madam Chair, I will do so.
Okay, Senator Champion makes a motion for Senate 675, Senate File 675 to, let me see where it goes. Oh, moves to the Committee on Rules.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a brief comment. I don't want to in any way drag this matter out. I have always opposed the move to change the local county auditors and treasurers, et cetera, from an elected position to an appointment position. And consistent with that, I will be opposing the motion to move this forward. And I just wanted to indicate to the members and to Senator Pappas the reason why I am voting against it is I just do not believe in this appointment process and removing the right of the voters to elect.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Okay. With the motion, all in favor of moving Senate File 675 to the Committee on Rules, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Senator Eakin.
Senator Eakin. A couple more quick bills I can see.
Yes.
Right, Senator Limmer? Okay. Which one did you want to start with, Senator Eakin?
We'll start with the CARE Act first. That would be Senate File 107.
All right. Senate File 107. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I do have an amendment that I would like to be offered as well, but I'll first just describe what the bill does very quickly, and then we can move on to the amendment.
Second, Senator Eakin, do we have your amendment?
We will be
getting your amendment shortly. Okay, so go ahead, Senator Eakin.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 107 is called the CARE Act, and this stands for Caregiver Advice Record, Record and Enable Act. The bill has very broad support from the AARP and a host of other health groups such as the Alzheimer's Association, the MS Society, the Heart and Cancer Associations, along with the Center on Aging, the Board on Aging, and the Minnesota Area Agencies on Aging. We believe that the current version of the bill strikes a compromise that addresses the concerns of the Hospital Association and the Trial Lawyers Association, and improves the position of family caregivers in the hospital setting to ensure quality transitions from hospital to home and to help prevent unnecessary readmissions. What the bill does, just takes some common sense steps to ensure a smooth transition from the hospital to the home. The major provisions of the bill are three. There's the first one, which is to designate. It requires hospitals to designate a caregiver in the medical record within 24 hours of admission to a hospital for a patient. The second part is to notify the caregiver of a discharge from the hospital in a timely manner. And the third portion of the bill deals with aftercare tasks of the caregiver, providing them with training, information, and assistance in the provision of that care. And as the population ages in our society, we know this is going to become a bigger and bigger issue as you have more situations with people who are being who are being transferred from the hospital setting to the home setting. So that's what the bill is designed to address. The amendment to the bill, the A4 amendment, deals with provision that this committee would have jurisdiction over, and that's dealing with the issue of negligence. We were trying to strike a balance where We didn't want to create a new cause of action, or I guess we didn't want the failure to comply with the provision in this bill to in and of itself be used to initiate a lawsuit. Now, failure to comply could be used as evidence in a lawsuit that is initiated for another reason, but in and of itself, we didn't want this this bill and the provisions in it to be used for the purposes of initiating a lawsuit. And we did, again, come to an agreement, and we have been in contact with the Hospital Association on this, with the Trial Lawyers Association, met with Joel Carlson and Mary Krinke and Ben Pelletier earlier, and we worked out what we think is a workable solution, a compromise here, that accomplishes the goal that we were trying to achieve here. And that's what the A4 amendment does. I would like to make a couple of small changes as well through oral amendment to the A4 amendment. And if somebody would be interested, and I can describe the oral amendment, and if somebody would be interested in offering that, I'd appreciate that.
Go ahead and describe it, Senator Eakin, and we'll see if there's anyone willing to offer it.
Thank you. First of all, on the bill itself, if you look at page 4, line 5, we simply wanted to put the word private, before the word private, to add the word separate. Page 4, line 5. And page 4, line 6, after existing, add duties, comma. And on the amendment, line 1.5, before standard, add the word separate. Insert separate.
Could you repeat those, please?
Sure. page 4, line 5 of the bill, before private, insert separate. Again, on the bill, page 4, line 6, after existing, insert duties, comma. And on the A4 amendment, line 1.5, before standard, insert separate.
All right, before we consider the amendment on the merits, it sounds like you've been having conversations with the MAJ. So why don't we ask MAJ if they have anything they'd like to add in connection with this.
Sure, and Mr. Chair, Mr. Ben Pelletier.
Thank you.
Is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ben Pelletier. I'm the General Counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. Minnesota Hospital has been working on these transitions of care issues for quite some time. We, since 2010, have been identifying ways that we can improve the transitions and have significantly reduced the readmissions as a result over that time. This legislation is a continuation of that work. We're very pleased to work with Senator Eakin and the AARP on the legislation, and we're supportive of moving it forward.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman and members, Joel Carlson here for the Minnesota Association for Justice, and we support the amended language that Senator Eakin has presented to the committee and think it strikes an appropriate balance, and we would urge its support.
Thank you. Anyone else that you want to have testify on the bill, Senator Eakin?
And Mr. Chair, no other testifiers. Mary Jo George from AARP is here if there are any questions that people want to direct towards her.
Okay. Well, we have the A4 amendment to consider here. Is there anyone who wishes to offer it?
I will.
Senator Champion got his arm up first.
I'm
because I was looking in that direction. I don't know.
It's okay.
Senator Champion offers the A4 amendment as amended on line 5. Any further discussion on that amendment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Goodwin moves to amend the Senate File 107 on lines 5 and 6 as Senator Eakin described.
So moved.
Any further discussion on that amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to be heard in connection with Senate File 107? Further discussion from members of the committee? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Eakin, I might be a little bit out of date, but Minnesota, I believe, does have a vehicle called a health care declaration where we are able to appoint agents on our behalf when it comes to medical issues. Could you or any of your testifiers give us a little bit more background information as to the difference between the agent in this bill and a health care agent, and why this particular bill is necessary from the standpoint of appointing a new type of an agent in this aftercare issue?
Senator Eakin.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, I believe that many hospitals and many people are already doing many of these things. It's true, I don't think it replaces healthcare agents that currently exist, but there are situations where it's not occurring, and we're trying to make sure that it's being done everywhere. It's good practice. Every hospital should be doing this. One of the reasons I think the Hospital Association has been working with us so well on this is because they have been doing a good job, and they want to continue pursuing these practices and expanding on them. So we've had the Hospital Association has been very proactive in trying to promote these types of practices that have been so good. And Miss Mary Jo George would also like to address the question.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, thank you for the question. And if I may, I think what we tried to do with the definition of agent is to incorporate what you're referring to, a healthcare agent who serves in somebody's place when they're incapacitated. But we also know that under law that a parent of a minor child, for example, can speak on behalf of their child when they're a patient. So we were just trying to be inclusive when we defined this term agent. And why we wanted to make sure we included agents is what we're trying to do is the hospital asks the patient when they are in the hospital, if they want to designate a caregiver, and if they're incapacitated, then the healthcare agent can speak on their behalf. But we think it's really important that they're actually named in the medical record, because today, oftentimes, they're doing a lot of the bulk of the long-term care, but oftentimes they're maybe not part of the healthcare team. And so this really, you know, heightens their transparency in the system, and then from the fact that they're in the medical record, then there's a number of actions the hospital has to do. They have to notify the caregiver when there's a transfer or a discharge, and then they have to train them. So we think it is, you know, an important step as we look to reduce really the hospital readmissions, engaging family members.
Senator Newman.
It sounds as though the hospital is going to be actively engaged now in helping set up the agent that is designated in this bill. So my question for Mr. Carlson, who is now at the table, is if I'm correct that the hospital is now going to be actively engaged in assisting in setting up this relationship, I would ask that you discuss with us a little bit as to the potential liabilities that may arise, because we've just adopted some changes along those lines, and I would like you to just discuss with us and outline for us the legal relationships and potential liabilities, if you would.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Newman, I don't want to speak too far above my pay grade on your question, but I do want you to know, as we reviewed the bill, and I want to refer you to the language on the bill, If you look at the very end of the bill on lines 4.12 and 4.13, you will see that this section does not interfere with a healthcare agent who's operating under a healthcare directive in compliance with our law, Chapter 45C. So our review of this indicates that we're not changing the powers or duties of someone who's operating under a healthcare directive. And we don't see, in fact, as we read the language of the bill, there's no obligation for the patient to designate a caregiver. There's no obligation for the caregiver to follow through on any of the discharge directions that the hospital may give. And so what they were concerned about on the liability section was that some ministerial failure to comply with something in this directive would give an independent rise to a cause of action. And we understood that concern. It could give rise to a cause of action that is coupled with an inappropriate discharge, failure to give appropriate information, and unreasonable reliance on the information that was given to you. This doesn't impact that. That's our view of it, and that's how we've discussed it with the hospitals and the proponents of the bill.
Madam Chair,
Senator Newman,
I appreciate that explanation, and you have covered the thoughts and the concerns that I have, either Mr. Carlson or any of the other testifiers, if you could go through for me one more time the difference between the healthcare agent and the agent that is being agent that's being established under this bill. I'm still confused as to the difference and the need to have an agent established under this bill versus the healthcare agent.
And only,
Mr. Carlson.
Only briefly, Madam Chair, I would say that we view those definitionally in the bill as two distinct items. And if it's a healthcare agent operating under authority of 145C, they have duties and you have an obligation to them. If it is merely a designated caregiver, you have to give them the same information, but they don't have the legal status of a healthcare agent. Both are covered by the bill, but they are separate and distinct as far as what their legal obligations are. Does that make sense?
That helps.
They're not the same, is what I'm trying to say. There's two distinct definitions and activities.
Any other questions on the bill? If not, somebody like to move it?
I'm moving that.
Okay, Senator Champion moves Senate File 107, let's see where that goes. That moves to the floor. Okay, excellent. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Eakin has got Senate File 618 on Industrial Hemp Development Act.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill allows for the research of industrial hemp here in Minnesota. The federal government last year in the Farm Bill did allow for the research and development of industrial hemp in the states. There have been several states that have taken advantage of that. Actually, since the Farm Bill was signed, 19 states have now passed laws that allow for this research to take place. They include Illinois, Indiana, North Dakota, along with many others that have passed such legislation. Again, it enables states and universities to grow and research industrial hemp. Currently, there's bipartisan efforts at the federal level to remove hemp from the federal list of controlled substances. The list that includes narcotics like LSD and heroin, and to allow hemp to be grown in any state. It has, again, strong bipartisan support. The Industrial Hemp Farming Act, which was introduced by a U.S. Senator from Oregon, a Democrat, is also supported by the U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky. What is probably the area of concern or of interest here in this committee would involve the definition of industrial hemp, and this is what the federal government has changed. It now has a separate classification for industrial hemp separate from marijuana, and the definition is that it has to be below 0.3% THC levels. Anything above that would be considered marijuana. And one thing about industrial hemp, the THC level is so low that you can't possibly get high from it. Although I did have one person that told me that he did get high on it, but that was because it was a rope that was made of hemp, and he climbed up very high up on the rope.
I moved to table the bill.
So I told him that I stand corrected, but that was. But the fact is, you can't get high on industrial hemp, and it's used for a variety of purposes. It's one of the most versatile crops there is. It can be used for making paper, used for making clothing, used for making fuel, used for making plastic. For insulation in homes, for making concrete. It's one of the most versatile crops there is, and there's probably a lot of other uses that could be developed if we start researching it here in Minnesota. We actually import about $500 million worth of hemp-made products every year from other countries. We could be manufacturing those products right here at home, and I think it's important to note that our area of the country is one of the more conducive areas to growing this crop. In fact, during World War II, when hemp was legalized for production in order to win the war, there was actually a campaign that was called Hemp for Victory. They were actually encouraging 4-H clubs and groups to grow hemp for the war effort. But Minnesota was one of the largest producers in the nation. And so, again, it's a crop that has a lot of potential. Manufacturers have been known to locate where the crop is being grown, so it could bring manufacturing to our state as well. Those are the reasons that we're putting this bill forward. And again, the section of the bill that would be under this jurisdiction of this committee would involve the issue of the definition of hemp. Industrial hemp is the 0.3% or less of THC. And I'll stand for any questions that you may have.
Questions from members? Seeing none, do you have anyone else you would like to testify?
Nobody that has approached me. So,
all right, Senator Newman.
Just an observation, a comment for Senator Eakin. In my hometown of Hutchinson, there is a plant run by 3M, been there since the late 40s. And up until right after World War II, that particular facility was used in the manufacturing of industrial hemp. I just found it kind of interesting that my hometown used to make this stuff, and now it's finally coming back. So it does appear to me to be an agricultural product that will be of benefit to us in the state of Minnesota, and I do support your bill.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I do know that there were some that that did want to testify on the other side.
I see that now. Thank you. I would also like Mr. Backus to tell us what other sections apply to judiciary, because there are a couple others, Senator Eakin.
Madam Chair, members, actually kind of large parts of the bill are at least partly or more partly within our jurisdiction. In general, sections 1 to 16, which add the new industrial hemp chapter of law to the existing Commissioner of Ag's enforcement authority, that's kind of a little bit within our jurisdiction. There's issues relating to inspections and criminal and civil liability. So those sections are partly within our jurisdiction. And then Section 17 is a provision that provides that a prosecution under the new industrial hemp crime section would not preclude prosecution under the under the controlled substances chapter of law. That's section 17. The two definitions are in section 20, industrial hemp and marijuana, so Senator Eakin mentioned those. And then in some respects, sections 21 and 22 are tangentially in our jurisdiction just because that's where it authorizes industrial hemp. And then finally, sections 20 7 and 28 are within our jurisdiction. 28 is a change to the definition of marijuana to acknowledge that industrial hemp does not qualify as marijuana. That's in the Controlled Substance Chapter of Law. And then Section 27 provides an affirmative defense for the possession of marijuana under the Controlled Substance Law if it basically is industrial hemp. So those are other sections you might want to at least look at.
Like I said, just a couple, Senator Egan. Next, I guess we do have a couple of people here who would like to testify. Drew Evans from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Drew Evans. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Our primary concern that we wanted to share with the committee today relates primarily to the definition that is changing under Chapter 152, the definition of marijuana. And I think it is helpful for the committee to understand that currently the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, in order to identify marijuana consistent with that chapter, has a process in place where we would examine the suspected marijuana under a microscope and then possibly follow that up with a color test that we use, just indicating the presence of THC. The bill before you changes the definition of hemp, appropriately so, to have this low level of THC. However, by changing the statute in 152 to change the definition of marijuana, it would place upon the Bureau a burden to prove not only that it is marijuana, but it's not industrial hemp. In other words, we would have to come up with a new process and procedure which would have fiscal impact on the BCA because we do not currently quantify the percentage of THC in suspected marijuana coming into the Bureau. So that's our primary concern, is that we do not do that currently because current law does not require us to. It would increase the burden on our laboratory in terms of both time and resources to make those determinations for criminal cases.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. And I do see that the bill does have to go to state and local government after this. Do you have a fiscal note prepared at this point?
We do not at this point. Examining internally with our staff the interplay between the new definitions, defining hemp, and then with the Chapter 152 and exactly what that would mean for prosecutions in the state. And we're currently undergoing that analysis internally.
Thank you. All right. Any questions for
Madam
Mr.
Chair?
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, while we have the testifier here, sir, is there any conflict in law between if this became state law and federal law? Is there any conflict that you know of?
Mr. Evans?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I was provided the federal classification of hemp does define hemp as being under, it'd be consistent with this law as 0.3% or less.
One other question, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
In the purposes of law enforcement, could marijuana plants be planted in a field of industrial hemp, and would one be able to define that difference from a distance away?
Mr. Evans?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, from a distance, no. That's where some of the other oversight and rulemaking would come into play, an inspection of those particular fields. But even under part of the reason we'd require additional processes internally is that examination under the microscope, the plants would look essentially the same.
Madam Chair, is there a concern of law enforcement that we might have illegal marijuana plants in an industrial hemp field?
Well,
it would be difficult to enforce or at least distinguish, and one could have basically a camouflaged marijuana growing field that would be now considered illegal.
Senator Limmer, Mr. Madam Evans, Chair. Or Senator Eakins.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, you wouldn't grow marijuana anywhere near hemp because they are related, and they would cross-pollinate, and that would destroy the quality of the marijuana. The fact is true, it also has a detrimental impact on the hemp, so you would not see marijuana being grown next to hemp or anywhere near industrial hemp for that reason. So One way to, I guess, prevent marijuana from being grown in an area is to have industrial hemp there, because, again, people wouldn't want to grow it there.
Ms. Madam Chair?
Senator Limmer?
I don't know who was insulted more.
Senator Lass, please.
Can I give you some history here? My understanding is that the growers of industrial hemp, the purpose is to get the fiber from the stalk, basically, and the oil from the seeds. But to get the most stalk possible, they want to grow it narrow, close together, and as tall as they can, which is different than someone who's growing marijuana for individual consumption as, you know, as a drug. They want it shorter, broader leaves, that kind of stuff. So I think if you were to get close to it and be able to eyeball it, at least if they're trying to maximize their industrial hemp product, you'd probably find a distinction visually that you could tell the difference between, I don't know what they look like under the microscope, but for what it's worth, that's what I've been informed.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know where Senator Eakin heard that, but I heard the similar story, and it came from, I believe, Colorado may have had industrial hemp before they legalized marijuana, and so people just thought, let's just, you know, we're growing one, let's just grow the other, and it actually destroyed both crops. So that was a news story.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I'm sure I just remember seeing news accounts of law enforcement cutting down marijuana plants, and those marijuana plants seem to be 12 and 15 feet high and then thrown in a pile that's burning. That was considered illegal. I don't know if they knew the difference or not between industrial hemp or not, but those are the pictures I've seen, and so I'm...
Senator Limmer, how far were they standing away from the fire?
I don't know if more important were they standing downwind from the fire, Madam Chair. So I don't know. I don't have a reference on this to make a clear decision.
All right, thank you. Next is Dave Kolb, Chief of the Champlain Police Department. Chief Kolb.
Madam Chair, my name is David Kolb. I'm the police chief in Champlain. However, I'm here representing the State Police Chiefs Association, and also in that capacity, I'm seated on the governor's task force on medical marijuana. I want to apologize to Senator Eakin that we weren't able to reach out and have some of these discussions prior to the hearing, but we do have some concerns. And I think on a – just to start with Senator Limmer's comments on the commingling of the marijuana versus the hemp, I think on a macro level as an industry it makes sense that they don't want to cross-pollinate and destroy their crops. We do have some concerns more on a micro level that somebody may use it in a smaller plot, one as cover for the other. But really I think the bigger concern we have, just trying to think big picture, is that there's a paradigm change here where for the first time you will have cannabis plants growing legally in open fields. And we just have concerns about what happens to all of that plant material. Clearly, if the agricultural product is the fiber and you want the long stalks, I don't think a patrol officer would have too much difficulty realizing that's not going to be used recreationally. But the question becomes, what happens to all the rest of the plant material in that field? Is it chopped? Is it baled? Is it disposed of properly? I think there are some assumptions made that a person with a licensed plot is using it properly for agricultural purposes, and we don't question the agricultural value. We just have more concerns about where is the rest of that plant material going and who is transporting it. Section 22 talks about possession and transport of this material, and again, thinking just the paradigm change here where cannabis plants, whether they're hemp or marijuana or regardless of the THC level, we have concerns about what that means from an enforcement standpoint, really on the street when these things are being moved around.
Chief, is that something that would probably be addressed in rulemaking?
I think we'd like to have some discussions about how that could be worded to prevent those problems.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make note that there is a licensing requirement in here that's pretty extensive. So to determine whether or not somebody has a license that is growing it is not that going to be that complicated. And if they don't have a license, then they'll, you know, suffer the consequences. They have to also submit a background check. So I just want to make sure that that's, you know, those safeguards are understood that they are in here.
Mr. Chair?
Chief.
The licensing of the grower, I think, is covered here. Our concern, however, is we don't necessarily know that that's who's going to be transporting this material. And as Mr. Evans testified, without being able to tell the THC level, we have essentially some form of cannabis plant material being transported now and just trying to figure out how do we ensure that that really is the correct product here. That's our concern.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Eakin.
As far as, and Senator Goodwin is correct in that there's a certification process one has to go through. The Ag Department is going to be monitoring these plots. It's going to be done on a limited scale because it's being done for research purposes. So it's going to be very controlled and monitored very closely. And I think it's important to note, too, as far as in the transport of these products, it's obvious it's going to be a different kind of material for industrial hemp. You're going to be baling it up for the fiber product. So you're getting the stock. You're going to be harvesting the seeds for oils and things of that nature. And for marijuana, it's the flower of the crop that you're going to have. So it's a different portion of the crop that you're utilizing for marijuana as opposed to industrial hemp. So you can very easily visibly see the difference between those crops because of their uses. And this is the first time, and I'm glad to work with law enforcement as we move forward to address some of the concerns that they have here. This is the very first time that we have been approached, and this issue's been out there for a while. We've already had one other bill hearing, we were not approached before the hearing took place here today while the committee was taking place. So we'd like to, you know, work with law enforcement as we move forward. But I think that there's a lot of the concerns that are being expressed here. Again, I think many of them are being addressed through the certification process. The fact that the two crops are harvested differently and are transported in different ways and in different forms, I think, addresses many of those concerns.
Any other testimony anyone would like to offer in connection with this? Mr. Franklin.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. This has been a difficult issue for us because, as you know, many of these will probably be located in the agricultural areas that we police. I will not reiterate the concerns that have already been highlighted on. I would just say that we have some concerns with regards to what we have done a little bit of research on, and that's packaging and how you can put marijuana inside of hemp, ship hemp back and forth, and you can't detect it. So many of the tools that we have in dogs and other kinds of things are not detectable because of the hemp and other kinds of things. So we have concerns about that, and BCA has already testified with regards to the concerns of testing. Again, licensing, other kinds of things, I think there's ways that we can work through this. We're interested in how these products can be made. We're all for that. But we also realize the creativity of some of our young people and how they are able to take a product and use it that's already been so demonstrated by your earlier comments. They're very creative. So we don't know what those concerns are going to be, but want to continue to work on this in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Does Tom Peterson from the Farmers Union wish to testify? Mr. Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I just want to be clear, we're very supportive of the bill and feel very confident that we can work out some of the issues you've heard today. I just wanted to point out Canada, you know, has grown since 2002 just across the board. So our farmers in northwestern Minnesota, they see it. It's grown in 100,000, 200,000 acres in Canada. I have not seen law enforcement be a big issue in Canada. It's been a real good crop. And, again, they grow it they process it, and then they send it here. And we make all the products out of it and everything. And so I really encourage you. I think it's a really good opportunity for our farmers here in Minnesota. And again, just to put it in context, too, about how much we would grow, I think I saw Canada grew 200,000 acres last year. On the other years, from up the 10 years previous, they grew anywhere from 6,000 to 50,000 acres. Senator Eakin has one county that grows 100,000 acres of wheat a year that he represents. So it's not going to be something we're going to grow. We hope it really takes off and grows everywhere. But in context, I think it is, because as a farmer, you have to be licensed. And back when we had it before, farmers were licensed in the 40s when we grew it then, too. And so I think the safeguards are in place, and as we go into the rulemaking, we'll be working on some of those issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any idea of what the economic impact or benefit to the state of Minnesota would be if industrial hemp is authorized?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I do know that $500 million worth of hemp-made products are imported to the United States every year. So that's significant. And the thought is that if we produced it here and started manufacturing hemp-made products here, it would grow even beyond that.
So. Mr. Peters.
Yeah, one other thing I think is really important in this discussion is in talking about how they envision it, you know, going in other counties and talking to our other farmers' unions around the state is that when we go to start growing it, it's probably going to grow with a manufacturer. So a manufacturer is going to have either a point where they're going to be exporting it to another state where they're going to gather it. So they're going to go out to McLeod County, and they're going to contract with, six farmers in McLeod County most likely and grow it there and process it there. They're not going to, the models we've seen even in Canada, it's kind of integrated. So they work with the company that they grow it for, or people just grow small amounts in niche market, but they don't grow it in Twin Valley and in McLeod County and Pine County. They grow it in a localized area and then and produce it with a product, whether they're making paper, rope, or biofuels or something like that.
Thank you. Is there any further testimony on this bill? Any further comments from members of the committee? Is there a motion?
I'll make the motion.
Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 618 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Welcome, Senator. All right, Senate File 857. This is Senator Sheeran's bill. She's absent today, and Senator Newman, co-author of the bill, is going to present it. Senator Newman, Silver Alert.
Mr. Chair, members, this is a bill that in which Senator Sheeran is the chief author. I am a co-author. She has requested that I present her bill this afternoon. I'm going to go through the bill very, very briefly, and then I do have an amendment that I would be offering. Members, this is a bill that would establish a working group convened by the Commissioner of Public Safety to study the need for a silver alert system to aid in the recovery of persons who are senior citizens with dementia, traumatic brain injury, Alzheimer's, or other mental disabilities. There is a concern about folks in this category, and I would parenthetically indicate that I suspect that with the baby boomers beginning to get older, this is probably a problem that is going to increase, not decrease. And the idea is that if the working group comes up with a conclusion that the silver alert system is something that is necessary, that they would then be making recommendations to establish the system. In this particular bill, there is a requirement that the working group be convened by the middle of September, and then provide us with a report by the middle of January of next year to the ranking chairs and minority members of the Senate, House committees and divisions that deal with human services. I do have a member of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension that is here. Ms. Janelle Rasmussen that can testify as to the bill also. Before I ask her to testify, however, Mr. Chair, I would offer the A1 amendment as an author's amendment.
All right, can you just tell us real quick what the amendment does?
Sure. The in the bill itself, there is some language regarding the one of the organizations that will have a seat at the table of this working group as being the traumatic brain injury organization, and in the A1 amendment, we are specifically identifying the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance as the organization that will have a seat at the table. We are also inserting some language that the working group will include a recommendation or include in their discussions the Silver Alert program from a multicultural perspective. There are some minority groups that have requested specifically to have a seat at the table, and the way Senator Sharon wants to resolve that issue is to specifically indicate that the working group will consider this bill from a multicultural perspective rather than try and accommodate a very wide, potentially wide number of different minority groups that wanted to participate. And so that is the purpose of the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
Then perhaps at this point Ms. Rasmussen could address the bill. She is a member of the BCA and is an individual that also deals with the Amber Alert and is very conversant with these kinds of programs.
Ms. Rasmussen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janelle Rasmussen, and I am the Amber Alert Coordinator at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I know I spoke in this committee recently about the Amber Alert program and the tools that we use, like the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, to put information out to the public about missing persons or child abductions. The Silver Alert is a system throughout the United States that people are using to establish criteria and model programs where we would alert the public about an individual who meets a different set of criteria, much different than the Amber Alert program. And we currently do put information out on these types of cases in Minnesota right now through the Minnesota Crime Alert Network. We just call them different types of alerts, like endangered missing persons. Those would be cases that do not meet that Amber Alert criteria. This bill looks at creating a work group that would identify what we're doing in Minnesota, look at if there are any potential gaps from what is happening throughout the rest of the United States with Silver Alert programs or different models and different sets of criteria.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Rasmussen? Any further testimony from members of the audience? There being none, Senator Newman, you have a motion?
I do. Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 857 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the Committee on State and Local Government.
We have a motion before us. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator Newman. Members, that concludes our agenda for today. On Thursday, we're going to be starting at noon. The hearing should last until around 3 o'clock. So be prepared. We are going to hear the HHS omnibus bill, a child maltreatment bill, a bill on campaign finance board, and a resolution relating to the Equal Rights Amendment. So we'll have a lot to do on Thursday. And then on Friday, we will meet at 10 a.m. until at 1:30 p.m. to hear a series of federal law bills. So thank you for your work today, members, and we are adjourned.